All right, well, this is Jeff Carmack, Arts and Cultural Heritage Producer for KVSC News, and I'm sitting down with Nick Barth from Crew Wine Specialists. Good afternoon, Nick.
How are we today, Jeff?
Oh, doing splendid, splendid, splendid. So when we say wine tasting, I imagine a good number of our listeners might have a certain opinion, but I doubt that many of our listeners have actually been to a wine tasting. What goes on?
Well, first thing we do is we actually undress and we get a fire going and we rally around it. No, I'm totally kidding. Actually, a lot of our wine tastings are much different than a number of my colleagues. I myself am a certified sommelier, which means very little to so many people. I actually have a degree in wine. Can't get that here at St. Cloud State University, unfortunately. But I went to school through an agency called the International Sommeliers Guild. And they're all over the nation. They're the only state board-approved wine education program. And they kind of taught us how to taste wine. And one thing that a lot of people do when they taste wine is they overanalyze it. They think too much about it. They begin talking about the soil nitrate content or get hung up on the legs or the nose. Very romantic industry I'm in. And with our wine tastings, what we try to do is that we see entertainment as the focal point and wine as the medium. So when I talk about my wine tastings, it may be a different experience than one you may have been to. But our wine tastings, we try to encourage people to grow their knowledge while they have fun along the way. Now, of course, there's alcohol involved, so it's always a little more fun than if it were to be a coffee tasting or a tea tasting, but those are fun as well. So our wine tastings kind of start out with us looking in and examining the wine, kind of talking a little bit about it. Get the basics. What do you need to know about wine? What am I looking for? As we look through it, what does the color tell me? If there's something floating in it, what am I supposed to know? We go from there into the nose, and we kind of talk about the smells. What is it that makes a wine smell winey, if you would? What are the different components to a wine? How does it made to smell like this? And then, of course, our favorite part where we get to rehydrate the palate with a delicious wine sip. So we'll talk about what flavors that we do, things like that. Along the way, though, we always like to educate people on what is wine? What is the culture of wine? What are we talking about? Is wine just belong at the dinner table? Is it something that is in a box marked Franzia? There's all sorts of different wine-related bottles and topics and things like that. So as we move along throughout the course of the evening, we try to educate you on the culture and how we believe that wine's place is far beyond the dinner table. Wine is so popular here in the United States, and 2009 will actually mark a really big milestone for the United States. We will consume more wine than any other country in the world in 2009 by volume. Of course, we won't beat Luxembourg by capita, but they have, like, what, 8 people?
per
capita. And, you know, they're basically touching every major wine-producing region in the world, so we'll never beat them per capita, but in volume we will. Wine has outsold beer and spirits in the United States for the second time in a row, and that's a huge deal. Founded on the Budweisers in the upper Midwest here, the old Milwaukee's best. And then spirits as well. You know, we've got a lot of heritage with our grain whiskeys in the United States, from Bourbon County, Kentucky, to Tennessee whiskey, the gentleman known as Jack Daniels. So wine is really becoming more and more apparent. And the part of that I really like about wine is the number of novices joining the industry. There are so many people who have not known anything beyond White Zinfandel. And White Zinfandel is a great stepping stone to step into wine. And then once people get to that point, that's where the wine tastings really help them evolve their knowledge base. When we talk about boxed wine, we talk about bottled wine. So we'll kind of educate people on different bottle styles. We'll educate people on whatever they want to know. That's the beauty of our intimacy of our smaller wine tastings when we get those groups of 25 to 30. A lot of people asking questions. What is it you want to know? You would be surprised at how many people, their jaws just drop when they finally realize that the name on the bottle is the name of the grape used to make the wine. I stand up there and I could tell you all night long, I could tell you all about wine and you'll absorb some of that information. But when I finally tell people that Riesling is the name of the grape used to make that wine, or Merlot is the name of the grape used to make that wine, they can't believe it. Well, why didn't anyone ever tell us? And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we overthink it sometimes. We don't even think to tell you that. We just assume you know it, and of course we know what happens when we assume. So with our wine tasting, what separates us, again, from our colleagues is that we just want to get it back to the basics. Make wine accessible. Let's enjoy the wine. Let's talk about the different food pairings. Fear no food pairing. That's one of the most important things I ever tell people when they first get into wine. Think of wine as your ketchup, your mustard, your salt, or your pepper. It's a condiment at the table. If you have an hour-long Julia Child prepared recipe in the kitchen, you don't want to be bringing out a $450 bottle, because obviously the food is going to be the showcase at that point. So there's a lot of things that go inside of our wine tastings, and again, they're all kind of custom to each theme that we do. So the very last wine tasting that we did was a French wine tasting. We had a bunch of delicious treats from our French neighbors. Some of the highest priced bottles I think I've ever done in a wine tasting. The one before that, we did some wine from the Pacific Northwest, so looking at Washington and Oregon, becoming a huge player domestically as far as production goes. Of course, California is still accounting for some 85 to 90% of the total production here in the United States. And every single tasting, I have a half dozen people that come up to me and say, you know, I went out to Napa or Sonoma last year, you know, and I got to go to these great wineries. And it's really good to have some great producers here locally, and by locally, I mean domestically, that allow people to go and share and learn about the winemaking process. Because it's only aiding in educating people and getting people more involved in the wine culture. That was a really long answer to such a short question. But again, it's one of those things that I can't just tell you what we do at a wine tasting outside of we drink, we laugh, we enjoy, we share, and we have an absolute riot while we do it. We make wine fun, we laugh about it, and we tell you what we need to tell you.
And that basically is what a wine tasting is. So it isn't such just a simple question, although it is a simple question. And, you know, it could be something, well, you know, people may not have experienced it before. You know, it's going to be something a little bit foreign to them. So there is a whole lot of information. And, well, it's more than information. It is the culture
it
in itself.
Is. We're in central Minnesota. I did not realize that there was anything beyond Kraft Singles and a green can that had said Parmesan on it for cheese. I didn't know that Boone's Farm, you know, wasn't necessarily a wine per se or Arbor Mist. I mean, those were the things that I grew up with. Those are the things that I saw. And so in central Minnesota, and we're not exclusive, please don't think that I'm harping on central Minnesota. This is a nationwide epidemic here. And those are all, they all have their place, just as, you know, different spirits have their place, you know, depending on what part of the evening you're in or what state of mind you are in, things like that, you know, what you're interested in. Those have their place. But when I talk about wine, I mean something made only from grapes. And so when we do spirits tasting, for example, we do cognac tastings, which is simply just brandy from the cognac region of France, such as we are central Minnesotans from central Minnesota. We're still people from central Minnesota, and that's the same that goes with cognac. It's just brandy from a region designated in France, as is Champagne, as is Chianti. These are all regions. But when we do these wine tastings and we start to tell people about all of these different experiences, we like to have cognac after the meal. It's a great aperitif. It's a great digestive. You know, there's a certain place for everything, and there certainly is a place for Arbor Mist and Boone's Farm. You're going to hear a certified sommelier on the air. Actually, we might have to take this out of the radio segment and say that there is a place for Boone's Farm and Arbor Mist. It's when you're sitting on the back deck and it's hot and, you know, you're making up some daiquiris and you have a little splash of that and it tastes fruity and sweetie, you know, and you can run back to your volleyball game or whatever it is you're doing outside. So there is a place for everything. And that's, I think, what the whole point of this show is that we're not pretentious. A lot of my colleagues are pretentious. They're going to tell you all about you should only be drinking Right Bank Bordeaux from the 2005 vintage, or, you know, the best wines in the world come from Spain and the Rioja region. There's a great time and a great place for everything. So those are the different cultural experiences we have. Now, if you're going clubbing, I don't know how many people are going to ask for a glass of wine. And so I can't really always help people in that regards. But you look at a wine list and it's the thickness of a phone book, or you look at a liquor store and it looks like a warehouse and there's shelf upon shelf upon shelf. Who isn't going to be intimidated by something like that? So we try in these wine tastings to give people little tools to use in order to help them sift through the many layers of wine in the world and in the commercial marketplace.
Yeah, it's to pick the right wine for the right occasion, the right beverage for the right occasion. I mean, you know, there's certainly floating down a river on a inner tube with the box of wine taken out of the box, tied up to the inner tube with you. But then there's the, okay, we're, you know, having a dinner party. Hmm. You know, there's a wide spectrum. You know, it depends upon what you're doing.
Absolutely.
And this wine culture has gone back hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And it is an opening of a new door into expanding your horizons, if you will.
Yeah. I think, you know, we talk about wine and depending on how you view the world and its length, you know, we're talking some 7,000 years of wine education from post-Neanderthal fermentation in some deer skin with some grapes that was very low alcohol to today's California Zinfandels from Dry Creek that range somewhere in the realm of 16% alcohol by volume. And one of my favorite stories to tell is actually about boxed wine. It gets a bad rap, first of all, because we talk about different occasions and we talk about, you know, floating down the river and the right thing. I used to run a place in town here, a little bistro in downtown St. Cloud. And I always told people that if I had a full kitchen, I would serve boxed wine as my house wine. And the reason for that is, A, it's actually delicious from the right producers. And it's incredibly cost efficient for both the consumer and for the proprietor, as well as the preservation of the wine. It's not exposed to air. Air turns wine to vinegar. And so in a box, it's never exposed to air. It's really just letting out the wine. So I like to tell people a little bit about boxed wine. So in the 1990s, we had an awesome opportunity to taste a ton of Franzia. I was not old enough to taste Franzia or the Sutterholm or the Gallo or any of the boxed wines, but my mother always had a box of white Zinfandel. And so that's kind of what I grew up thinking. So the very first Thanksgiving where I could drink, I brought a box of Franzia thinking I was bringing the wine to Thanksgiving. Well, first of all, as far as pairings go, you really couldn't pick a worse wine to pair with Thanksgiving dinner. But beyond that, but you know, if it wasn't for boxed wine, if it wasn't for white Zinfandel in the 1990s, we wouldn't have these delicious Zinfandels, these red Zinfandels that all of these wine aficionados rave about. The crop was abundant. There was a ton of it and more than the demand asked for. So the supply was great. The demand was low and they needed to do something with all these grapes. So they crushed them halfway. They made a pink little wine and added some sugar. And all of a sudden you got a sweet, delicious treat. And it got people into wine. So these people who are highfalutin or snobbery or whatever you want to call it, based on the different wines of the world and what they think is greater quality, don't realize that if it wasn't for white Zinfandel, many people would not be in this industry, and therefore there wouldn't be as much growth. You know, in 1980, I think it was the early 80s, there was somewhere in the realm of 500 wineries in California. Today, there's over 3,000. And the reason for that is just because we have such a growing demand for it. It's becoming a part of our culture, something that's been, and certainly in Italy with the Romans since basically, you know, right 100 AD, you know, 100 BC, somewhere right in the biblical time there. So depending on how you look at it, this white Zinfandel has allowed our wine industry to grow. But if you go out there and you ask about them, there's some amazing values in a box. You can keep it a lot longer. Bottles are fallible. It's factual. I mean, there's been plenty of things that can go wrong. So
yeah, they can break.
They can break, especially if you're on the river. I mean, you can't tie a bottle to a river open.
You're not supposed to take glass in the river anyway. So there you go. That box wine is portable and durable.
And sometimes good.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We are talking with Nick Barth from Cru Wine Specialists and continuing our conversation about the world of wine and culture. Just the world opening up with the wine tasting. It has been something that's been around for a long, long, long time. And, you know, we are seeing the interest with not just within central Minnesota, but all over the place, obviously, with, you know, wine being the beverage of choice above others nowadays. You've got a couple of nonprofit fundraisers coming up you were talking about. Just people are looking for something to do that's interesting and cultural.
Sure.
And this certainly, this certainly is it. What are these nonprofits, what angle are they taking on this?
Sure, great question. Actually, as Jeff mentioned earlier, I own a company named Crew Wine Specialists, and we do wine tastings all over the state for a variety of organizations and interests. And one of our primary markets is not-for-profit organizations or charity organizations. And one of the largest charity organizations that I started with that kind of let me get my foot in the door was the St. Cloud Symphony Orchestra. And I think it was about 3 years ago that we had our first event. And it's really quite interesting. One of the board members had heard on NPR that what you're drinking changes flavors and aromas by what you're listening to. Very interesting stuff. It has to do with if you're listening to a rock concert, your light-bodied Riesling will probably be lost, whereas maybe a full-bodied Cabernet Sauvignon might be able to hold up to that edgy music. They haven't ever sat down and studied this per se, what wines go with what music, but the idea was that your palate and your aromas, your olfactory change depending on what you're listening to. So we decided to take it one step further, and we decided to pair wines with music. So the St. Cloud Symphony Orchestra has live performers come up, six different groups from quartets to soloists come up and do a musical piece, and then we will pair a wine to it. Now, it may sound crazy and bizarre, but it actually worked. And the best part was, after about the fourth wine, I got up on stage and said, I can't believe this. This is actually working. Like, I really feel like this is an unbelievable pairing. Here's an example. One of their musicians plays a marimba. It's a giant wooden instrument percussion piece from Africa. And so we thought, well, what can we pair with that will fit that? So we thought, what's going to be woody? We're going to have some oak aging or some oak flavors. What is going to be kind of big or full-bodied? And what's from Africa? So we got a Pinotage, which is South Africa's kind of claim to grape. It's a hybrid that they have. And we decided to pair that with this. Other instances are where we had a German composer. So we paired a German wine with it. And I think that each culture absolutely has its own flavor profile or its own style to wine. So if you're listening to something from a German composer, the same wavelength, or as we call it in the industry, terroir, T-E-R-R-I-O-R, it means kind of a sense of place, almost a spirituality to the wine, and I think that that also plays through in the music. I think if we listen to a German composer versus a Russian composer, we're going to hear vastly different things from these two regions. And that's where we were able to pair this in. So there's one example. That's the St. Cloud Symphony Duets. That's on February 5th, which is a Friday night at, I think it starts at 6 p.m. down at Pioneer Place on 5th. Awesome organization to support, by the way, the St. Cloud Symphony Orchestra, and not to get political because that's not what I do. Had a lot of their funding cut this last year, which many, many organizations did. And so this is just a way for them to try to make up some of that ground. Another organization that we'll be working with immediately in February is Central Minnesota Habitat for Humanity. We'll be doing a wine tasting for them actually the following evening, the 6th, at the Civic Center. And the Habitat for Humanity has obviously rebuilt a ton of houses all over the world. They have done a lot of work here locally. And so we're doing a 5-course sit-down dinner with 6 wines and then pairing each wine to a video testimonial. And it's really touching, actually, to hear these stories from these different families who have been helped. And so the wine adds an entertainment value to the event. And of course, food and wine pairing. I mean, it can be daunting sometimes. There's a million labels plus out there, and there's obviously a million different food combinations plus, and how are you going to find the right one for the right one? And that's what we teach you. Maybe there isn't the right one for the right one. But there was a really great organization that I want to just touch on for a sec that we worked with at the beginning of December. And it was the first time in all my work with not-for-profit organizations that I had to kind of step away because I was tearing up a little bit after hearing from this organization. It's a new one called Roll With It. It's in Central Minnesota. And what they do is they actually get wheelchairs for children who maybe can't afford it or don't have access to it. And it also encourages them to help to go out and join a team or some variation of a sport or something like that. And we did this wine tasting. It was wonderful. People loved it. One of their large supporters, Marco and Bernix, they're great supporters of this organization. And at the end of it, the woman who was hosting the event stood up and said, you know, if you read the informational packet, you go home, you sit down, you'll see what everybody's saying right now, what all these children want, is they're so happy to have this so they can be a part of a team. You know, I was a two-sport athlete in high school, played a lot of intramurals in college, and I love being a part of a team. It's one of my favorite things, actually, being a part of a team. And so that really touched me. It really hit home. And so it's great to be a part of these organizations and to be able to help these organizations with a fun, entertaining event. So there's all sorts of them out there that we work with, but those are just a few over the last couple months that we'll be doing work with.
Well, it is interesting because you don't think when you think originally about wine tasting, you don't think of that. However, if you think about it a little further, what is a wine tasting? You're slowing down, enjoying the moment, and picking up on the subtleties of the moment and what those subtleties are. And when you look at the different nonprofits, that's an excellent fit. I'm very familiar with some of these nonprofits as well. And once you start looking at exactly how they do things and exactly how they change the lives of other people, it is amazing, because it doesn't take much to radically change somebody's life for the better. Mm-hmm. And the role with it, that new organization that's out, that's something that, you know, I was a multi-sport athlete as well at one point. And, you know, it's one of those things.
About 30 pounds ago for me.
But yeah, the role with it, you know, you don't think about how somebody might not be experiencing that, how such a subtle little thing, like just being part of a team, really can change somebody's life for the better. So when you start looking at things, well, you start looking at those subtleties, those minute particulars of life, and you start thinking, well, how can I make just something just a little bit better? You know, not only do the nonprofits do this, but, you know, just sitting back and getting an appropriate wine, either for dinner or for hanging out with friends, who knows where that could take you. And, you know, it's really a difference between quality and quantity. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain beverages I no longer drink because the quality of them wrecks havoc with me. We'll just put it that way to be polite. And yeah, so those things don't exist in my life anymore, but others do. So it's within this venue of the wine tasting that, you know, who knows, you can find out different ways of enhancing your life and making life enjoyable in ways maybe never imagined before.
I think you hit it right on the head too. I think that's one of the main things that we do. We slow everything down. We slow down so you can heighten your senses. People come to me and they say, how do you know a wine is a wine just by looking at it and smelling it? Part of our education program was actually where we had 16 glasses sat in front of us for the final, and we had to determine just by looking at them, tasting them, and smelling them, where they were from. Sub-appellation included, so you couldn't just say Central Coast, California. You had to say Monterey, California, or Edna Valley, California. We also had to talk about the vintage and which year were the grapes picked, the alcohol content. We had to determine, a number of these things just by looking at it and smelling it and tasting it. And people say, how do you know that? Well, it's all learned. I can teach anyone how to taste, and I firmly believe that. As long as you have a sense of taste and a sense of smell, I can teach you how to identify these things. It's just practice, like anything else. The wine industry is exactly like the industry you are all in, all the listeners. It's you. It's what you know. It's your industry. To touch on the different spirits that you don't drink anymore, I always like to tell people why you don't drink them anymore. Every liquor, when it comes out of distillation, because they're going to make it in some variation of a distiller, is clear. And the more times they run it through this distill, the more refined it's going to become. There's a little body in there called a congener. And congeners are what give us headaches. So your plastic bottle of Philips is going to be less filtered, less distilled than your Premier glass bottle of Stoli Elite. And so there's going to be less congeners in Stoli Elite than there is going to be in your Philips vodka. Now, the same goes for caramel-colored liquors or your bourbons, your whiskeys, even your brandies. Those are all caramel color is added to those to give them that color. I have actually tasted a few clear scotches in my life. They're very cool. You drink it thinking you're drinking some variation of like a gin vodka, right? Because those are our clear bases in our mind, but really they're caramel colored. They're tasting like scotch without the caramel color. Now, some scotches, brandies, things like that get their color from wood aging, from oak aging. So when I say that they all come out of the distillery with that clear color, they can gain that kind of amber color from wood aging. So not a lot of caramel coloring needs to be added. Yeah. So there's a lot of different reasons that a wine may, or a spirit or a beer, or even a tea. I mean, let's talk about the difference between your Earl Grey by who makes a Nestle or something like that, mm-hmm. versus your Mighty Leaf, you know, loose leaf tea. I mean, there's definitely a different flavor component. There's definitely less additives on the Mighty Leaf than there is on the competitor, you know, the mainstream market logo. So we're seeing that in our culture. More and more people are leaning towards less adulterated wines, beers, spirits, but they are certainly acquired tastes. Think about the first time you had a Guinness. It's an acquired taste. It absolutely is. And wine's the same way, as I mentioned earlier in the show, when we talk about white Zinfandel. Nobody started off drinking Cabernet Sauvignon. You know, they had a little sweetie pie Riesling or white Zinfandel or something along that lines, and slowly they progressed, acquiring that taste for more flavor, more fruit, more bold, more body, things like that. So doesn't surprise me that you like good beer. You seem like the type of guy who would like good beer. you seem intelligent, and not to say that there isn't a place. I mean, think about Budweiser right now. Budweiser has come out with their whole wheat beer campaign. I mean, that's a huge market to drop into. They've come out with some of their handcraft beers here in central Minnesota with the Cold Spring Brewery. So there's all sorts of distributors, large and small alike, going after that craft beer appeal, because a lot of times we think of Sam Adams as kind of a large brewery, but really they are still considered a craft beer. They just have a decent marketing budget because we continue to drink it because it's pretty good tasting at the price point that they offer it. So while we can't always afford to drink, there was a Scottish beer that I had. It was like $7 for 12 ounces.
Mm-hmm. Like I mean, Chimay or something like that, or maybe like Samuel Smith's oatmeal stout.
Yeah. I mean, who can afford to drink like that? I mean, I can afford to drink like that sometimes, but not all the time. So you got to have a staple.
You can afford to drink like that in extreme moderation.
Yeah, exactly. So, there, you know, it's a huge component. Price is a huge component. We know that. We know price points are really driving the market in this economy. We've seen an influx in that $10 to $12 price point here in central Minnesota as far as sales go. However, good for you, America, bulk wine sales are down. Now, there's going to be all sorts of stats out there talking about all of these large producers that make a lot of wine. I call them robot wines. You literally push a button. How do you make 150 million bottles all taste the same? That's the whole beauty behind each grape being different and adding something different to that particular bottle. You do that by basically breaking it down to what its raw material and building it back up using all sorts of adulterations, not necessarily additives as far as flavor goes, but just different things that you can do to a wine. A conventional bottle of wine can have up to 240 different chemicals in it. A lot of people don't know that. And most wines are not vegan friendly. So any of you vegans out there, there are a few wines that put it on the label, but they do not legally have to put vegan wine or has animal products in on the label in order for them to produce it to the market. So price point is a huge part of the market right now, and finding those $12, $15 bottles that are the daily drinks are a wonderful find. There's plenty of stores around here that offer competitive pricing and great knowledge and staff. So seek them out, ask them what their favorite find is. That is the greatest thing you can do to a wine expert, is simply just ask them, lately, what have you found that really gets you going in that $12, $15 price point? Oh, I've got this wine, I've got this wine. Nobody ever asks them that. They come in and they say, I want a California Chardonnay. They come in and say, I want a Merlot from Napa Valley or something like that. And they never really get a chance to tell you what they found and why. So always, feel free to ask questions. Take the power back.
And broaden your horizons, definitely. I didn't know that thing about the vegan wine. You wouldn't think about wine being a vegan issue or not. So now I'm interested in, I don't know, is there a pork chop wine out there?
No, most of the time it's egg whites for fining. Okay. They'll use egg whites, but they also use different things to add color, fish oils. They're using a gelatin as a kind of a fining agent. So there's different chemicals used every day in conventional wines to make them look pretty on the shelf. And if you ever find a bottle of wine with something floating in it, buy it. It means it was unadulterated for the most part. Filtering wines can sometimes be a problem, taking out flavor, taking out color, different components, and then adding things into it as well. So there's stuff floating in it. I usually like to drink it. Most people wouldn't think that, though.
Yeah, they don't like the pulp, but,
I'm a big pulp guy. I like pulp in my orange juice. I like it in my wine. There's certainly lots of unfiltered beers here in the United States available to us as well.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for joining me today, Nick. And there'll be some more information on our website at kvsc.org.
And if you guys ever want to ask me a question, you can always check out our blog at crewwinespecialists.com. Just click on the blog icon. I'm sure you'll be able to link off right off of KVSC as well. I'd love to know what you're thinking about. I'd love to know what you want to know. Thank you very much, Jeff, for having me today.
And this has been Jeff Carmack reporting on arts and cultural heritage for KVSC News, where we urge everybody to have a safe and responsible and fun New Year's. This program is supported with funding by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and can be heard rebroadcast on a podcast at kvsc.org. KVSC is a proud member of Independent Public Radio.